Okay, hello and welcome to this weather training teleclass lecture, which is the first of the South Pacific teleclass series for 2007. My name is Jane Barnett and I'm speaking to you from Christchurch, New Zealand. I'd like to take this opportunity just to thank Paul Webber for his support with getting the South Pacific series launched and hope that members will enjoy the program that we have planned for you this year. Details of all these sessions are posted on the Webber Training website and can also be found on the final slide of today's presentation. Today's teleclass features a person who is well known in infection control circles here in New Zealand. Dr. Richard Everts is an infectious disease and microbiology consultant at Nelson Hospital in the Nelson and Marlborough district in the South Island. He has been interested in endoscope infection control issues for many years and was chair of the Standards New Zealand Endoscopy Committee between 2000 and 2001. He's also a member of GENCA, which I have to admit I had to ask Richard what this stood for, which is the Gastroenterology Nurses Council of Australia Working Party, and he's on there with the microbiological testing of endoscopes. I know that you will enjoy his presentation. Welcome, Richard, and thank you very much for being our guest speaker today.
Thanks, Jane. And if you look at my opening slide, you can see a picture of a beach in Nelson called Kaitiritiri, and that's the kind of weather we have at the moment for any of you listening in the Northern Hemisphere, such as you, Paul, in Canada, where it's minus 25 degrees Celsius at the moment. I'd just like you to imagine sitting on the Kaitiritiri beach and listening to this talk. Thanks for inviting me along, and as you say, I've been interested in endoscopy for some time, many years. And in fact, since I was called down to our endoscopy department at a hospital where I worked several years ago and found a whole lot of people doing a whole lot of interesting things and growing interesting bugs from endoscopes, and it took us a full year to really clean up the department and figure out what we should be doing and how. So I think there's a great potential for things to go wrong in endoscopy, but as you'll see from the slides that I show, that actually it's amazing how well we do. And I think it's amazing how well endoscopy cleaning and disinfection is done nowadays compared to 20 or 30 years ago. So if you look at the slide that's called plan, you can see I'm going to talk first about how staff might get bugs or bacteria from the patients, and secondly, which is really the main subject of this talk, is how patients may acquire bugs from each other through incorrectly reprocessed endoscopes, followed by some discussion about rinse water and contamination of rinse water. And then if there's time left, we can go through some topics that I know have been discussed in New Zealand in the last year or two and may be interesting to those overseas as well. Right, the next slide is a picture of me closely examining the end of a colonoscope and a shower of fecal material going under my right eye. And this isn't a real occurrence, but in fact, to illustrate that patient-to-staff transmission of organisms can occur, although I'm not sure how often it occurs. And so most of what I talk about for the next 5 minutes is theoretical, but important. The next slide is called standard precautions. And standard precautions are what we use to protect ourselves from the organisms that your endoscopy patients will carry. And the first and most important aspect of standard precautions is to clean your hands. Now, we now have alcohol-based hand gels that weren't around 5 or 10 years ago, and these gels are 10 to 100 times more powerful at killing bugs or killing bacteria than if you washed your hands in soap and water. So I'm sure all of you will have experienced this international wave of change from hand washing with soap and water to hand cleansing with alcohol-based gel. And not only is it more potent and effective than hand washing with soap and water, but it's faster and it leaves a moisturizer on your hands that reduces the risk of drying and other skin conditions. And studies have shown that compliance is better and that the rate of infections in areas where these are used is probably lower than in areas where ordinary hand washing has been used. So I encourage all of you to have alcohol-based hand gel available in your endoscopy units. Having said that, if you have some organic material on your hands, then you should wash them first, otherwise the alcohol will fix it to your skin. Now, if you're going to put your hand somewhere dirty, then the obvious thing to do is to wear gloves. And this is something that that some people are intuitively very good at, and others, especially surgeons, I hate to say, are not. But if you're going to be putting your hands anywhere near someone's mouth or genital or anal area, then if I was you, I would wear gloves. So the next slide, which is also titled Standard Precautions, says that you should wear gowns and face shields if you think you're going to be splashed with bodily fluids. And this means if you're coughed on or if you think there's going to be fecal material that's aerosoled around a room, any bodily fluid could get into your eye or your nose or your mouth and transmit organisms. So how does that apply to the situation in endoscopy? The slide titled What is the Risk? Says that based on an Indian study, in 13% of all endoscopy procedures, the endoscopist or the support staff are exposed to the patient's bodily fluids. It's for a GI endoscopy. So if you did 10 procedures in a day, then on 1.5 of those procedures, you would in some way be sprayed or splashed with the patient's bodily fluids. And a third of the time, that would be a splash in the eyes. Now, we know that the endoscopists seem to have higher rates of Helicobacter pylori. So presumably, this is evidence that they are being exposed to the patient's bodily fluids, especially during gastroscopy, although Helicobacter pylori may also be found in the stool. And yet, a study in 1991 showed that less than 10% of endoscopy staff, these are the staff who are actually doing the procedure, routinely wear personal protective equipment. What are the recommendations? For an endoscopist, I couldn't find any specific guideline for a gastrointestinal endoscopist, but there was a lot of discussion in various papers that implied or concluded that the endoscopist should wear some kind of gloves, gown, face shield to protect themselves against splashing. In the recent American bronchoscopy guidelines, they clearly say that for every procedure there should be a gown, gloves, mask and eye shield worn. And although I think I say here slides below we'll discuss TB infections, I'm not sure if I've actually included those in these talk, but the principle is that if the patient is thought to have tuberculosis, then first of all you would do everything possible to avoid bronchoscopy, and if you did need to do bronchoscopy, then preferably you would do it in an airborne isolation room and you would wear a N95 standard particulate respirator mask, and that would include everybody in the room. So we'll discuss that in a little more detail shortly. What about the cleaning and disinfection staff? The Australian GENSA group, which is the Gastroenterological Nurses Society of Australia, have recommended that anybody who's reprocessing an endoscope should wear an impervious gown, gloves that will not dissolve when they're in contact with the detergent or disinfectant agent, and a face shield to protect your eyes and face. On to the next slide, common sense. If there's an insect in your Tegaderm packet, discard it. And now we'll look at how to manage infectious patients who arrive in your suite. Now this is talking about not just the everyday patients who have no known infections, but patients who you suspect or are told have some kind of infection that could be dangerous to the staff. So, the next slide, first identify infectious patients. And the first point is that often you can't. And this means that the referrer may not tell you that the patient has MRSA, or may not tell you that the patient is carrying a multi-resistant Pseudomonas, or is suspected of having an infectious gastroenteritis. So good communication is preferable, but doesn't always happen, which is why we have standard precautions. But ideally, the referrer writes on the request form, please undertake colonoscopy, possible cryptosporidium infection. Or the orderly or porter who brings the patient down to the endoscopy unit says to you, watch out, this chap is in isolation in the ward because he has MRSA colonization. In our hospital, we use little labels, as you can see in the picture, which are clipped onto the infectious patients when they leave their isolation room, so that wherever they go in the hospital, including the endoscopy suite, there is a card that warns the staff that they are infectious. Although I'm not quite sure how good the compliance is with this in our hospital. So the next slide, to prevent spread by contact. This is for organisms that are spread by direct contact. In other words, you physically touch the patient, or that are spread by fomites. In other words, if the patient touches an item that they're carrying, like their glasses case or the side of the bed, and then you come along and touch that item, you will pick up the organism from the patient. So examples of this might be MRSA or a multi-resistant Pseudomonas or an ESBL mutation organism, or a gastroenteritis-causing organism like a viral or any bacterial gastroenteritis. And in order to protect yourselves against catching that infection from the patients, you would use contact isolation precautions, which is the next slide. And contact isolation precautions means that you wear a glove. You wear gloves for any contact with the patient or their immediate surroundings, and you wear a gown for any contact with the patient, or specifically if you're lifting the patient up or moving them around the bed and you think that the patient or their immediate surroundings will be touching your clothing. The next slide looks at infections that are spread by droplets. So these infections, such as meningococcus, whooping cough influenza, you probably won't see too many of these patients down in the endoscopy suite, but from time to time you will. And if we have an influenza pandemic, then these patients may pass influenza on to you via the droplet route. Droplets are from your mouth or nose, and as the patient speaks or coughs or sneezes, they come out and fly about up to a meter, and then they fall reasonably quickly to the ground. So if you were to catch one of these infections from the patient, you would have to stand within about a meter. As long as you're more than a meter away, you're okay. So if somebody enters your department and the staff say, well, this patient has whooping cough, then if you turn to the next slide, you would follow droplet isolation precautions. And this means that you wear a surgical mask when you're within 1 meter of the patient. The final group of organisms to talk about are those that are spread by the airborne route. And this includes tuberculosis, chickenpox, measles, and SARS coronavirus. These are organisms that also come out of the patient's mouth and nose, but rather than falling to the ground in large droplets, they form what's rather like an invisible mist or smoke of organisms that will hover in the air and spread throughout the entire room and stay airborne for up to hours. So any time you enter the room, you could be inhaling these organisms. You have to consider the whole room to be infectious. So moving on to the next slide, if you have one of these patients coming into your endoscopy suite, you have to follow airborne isolation precautions. And this means that anybody entering the room with that patient has to wear an N95 particulate respirator mask. Preferably, you would have the room at negative pressure relative to the outside rooms, so that those organisms that become airborne in the room will not also blow out under the door into the waiting room or corridors. So next slide is a summary. This is a summary of all the transmission-based precautions that we've just talked about for a patient with a known infection coming to endoscopy. For contact isolation, think about putting them last on the list so that the following patients aren't put at risk. Try to keep them physically separated from other patients, and if you have to handle the patient, you wear gloves and a gown. After they've left, you clean the surfaces and the equipment that's been touched by that patient, either with warm water and detergent or some kind of disinfectant. For droplet isolation, the most important thing is that you wear a surgical mask when you're within 1 metre of the patient. And you may choose to put a surgical mask on the patient as well. For airborne isolation, you use a negative pressure room if it's available, and you put a surgical mask on the patient for as long as is possible, and then all staff who are entering the room wear an N95 mask. And it's important that if you're going to wear an N95 mask, you make sure that you have been taught correctly how to use it so that it's fitting snug and tight around your face and that you're not inhaling air that's simply coming around the outside of the mask. Now, there's no particular rule for how long after the patient has left the room, say a patient with TB, that the room is infectious for. But if you consider that most modern buildings have ventilation rates of about 10 to 12 air changes per hour, then after about 20 minutes, you've actually reduced the amount of infectious material in the air down to a small percentage of what it was when the patient was in the room. And so in our hospital, we use about 20 minutes as a safe time for making the room available for others. Okay, so moving on to the next slide, which is needle stick injuries. And again, this is part of standard precautions, really. For any patient who comes to endoscopy, you should consider that they might have a bloodborne virus. And you can't tell from the end of the bed whether they have hepatitis B or C or HIV or not. So if you happen to stick yourself with a needle or a scalpel or any sharp object, then the first thing you should do is take off your glove or wherever you've been cut or scratched and try to squeeze blood out from the wound and rinse it under cold water. And because these viruses are very susceptible to antiseptics, then any antiseptic that you are willing to put on the wound should be washed onto it. So you could use a wipe or a cotton wool swab with some antiseptic on it, chlorhexidine, alcohol, iodine, anything that's available. And then finally, you follow your own institution's protocol for notification and documentation of the injury. But before filling out any forms, you want to squeeze, rinse, and apply an antiseptic. Okay, The next slide is patient-to-patient transmission. Before I go on, Jane, am I coming across clearly enough for everybody?
Yep, I certainly can hear you very well, so that's fine, Richard.
Okay. So we've talked about bacteria and viruses that could spread from the patient to you, but now we're going to talk about patient-to-patient transmission. And this is mainly through the endoscope itself, but it can also be through other routes. And I think recently in the literature there was an endoscopy suite in the United States where the practices of an anaesthetist or one of the staff members and reusing syringes or needles, and I can't remember the details, but that was thought to be the cause of transmission between patients of hepatitis C. But mostly we're going to talk about endoscopes and how to prevent transmission by the endoscope. The next slide has got a picture of a colon. And this is how it looks to the endoscopist. But in fact, there are millions of organisms in the bowel. And most of what I'm about to say is going to apply to gastrointestinal endoscopes and endoscopy. There have been transmissions from person to person through bronchoscopes, and many have been serious and have led to fatalities. But most of the transmission events reported are related to gastrointestinal scopes. And the obvious answer, the reason for that is that they are being put into places where there is a very heavy level of normal colonization. And I'm not aware of any reports of transmission from person to person through ear, nose and throat scopes or cystoscopes. So how many bacteria are there in the colon? This is the next slide. If you take 1 mil of stool, then there are about 1 million organisms in that 1 mil. If you take that mil of stool and dry it out, about a third of its weight is made up of solid bacteria, most of which are anaerobes. And anaerobes don't seem to be a particular problem with the person-to-person transmission and endoscopy, possibly because they die in between endoscopy procedures. But most of the organisms are anaerobes, and only 0.1% are aerobes, which might survive on the scope. So you might say, well, 0.1% isn't very much, but actually 0.1% of 100,000 million is still a lot of bacteria. And studies have shown that if you pull a colonoscope out of a patient, you could count, if you chose to do so, between 1 million and 1 billion organisms on that colonoscope. Now, that's a prediction based on how many organisms there are in normal stool. But remember that if a patient is coming to colonoscopy, they're more likely to have enteric pathogens in their stool than the average person in the community. And perhaps because they've got obstruction or chronic diarrhea or some reason like that. And there'll also be blood in the stool in someone who has a colonoscopy because of biopsies or tumours that are bleeding. And, of course, blood contains viral pathogens, which we'll talk more about shortly. The next slide just reminds us, using New Zealand statistics, that there is a small but significant proportion of the population who carry hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV. And these percentages, at least the hepatitis C and HIV percentages, are a lot higher overseas. So the next slide is a graphical depiction of putting an endoscope in one patient and then putting it into the next patient. So if you didn't clean the endoscope, you would take 1 million to 1,000 million organisms and you would inject those into the next person. You would inoculate them into the next person's colon. So what happens when you put something into the colon? Well, if you look at the next slide, this talks about the risk of transmission by rectal inoculation. And let's talk it through. If you put in a suppository into someone's rectum, you know that the drug is absorbed. so the mucosa of the rectum is capable of absorbing medications. If you put an enema with Clostridium difficile into, not with Clostridium difficile, with normal stool flora into a patient, that normal stool flora from a separate person will colonize the C. difficile patient's colon and overwhelm the Clostridium difficile, and those patients with chronic Clostridium difficile colitis will frequently have relief of their symptoms. So organisms that are inoculated into one person's rectum or colon will stay there and colonize the recipient's colon. If you get gonococcal proctitis, then that's an infection of an organism that can be inoculated into the rectum. And we know that hepatitis C, hepatitis B, and HIV can all be transmitted through anal intercourse. So these viruses, if they're inoculated into someone's colon, for example, they can potentially infect the recipient. The next slide looks at how often organisms are transmitted. Not transmitted and cause infection necessarily, but transmitted through endoscopy. In New Zealand, an audit was done over a 3-year period involving almost all endoscopy units in the country. And we know that compliance with the GENCA guidelines has been good. And what we've done in New Zealand is that we've been following a standard protocol for surveillance cultures of endoscopes. And based on the results of these surveillance cultures, we found 43 samples where an endoscope that had been fully cleaned and disinfected, flushed with alcohol, stored, and was in all ways ready for use on another case, actually yielded a moderate to heavy or a significant growth of some kind of flora, fecal flora or Pseudomonas. Now, it's possible that some of these positive cultures are a result of the collection technique, and it may be that in the process of taking the sample, the tip of the endoscope became contaminated from someone's hand or from the bench where the sample was being done, or I'm not sure whether all of these represent a significant transmission event, but from these data, if we assume they are, then one in every 163 endoscopies, and these will be mostly gastrointestinal endoscopies, you are potentially inoculating a small amount of feces from or saliva from one patient into the next case. So moving on to the next slide, how often does this cause infection? And the estimate that was done in the late 1990s was that only in about 1 in 1.8 million procedures does inoculation of these organisms from one patient to the next lead to a clinically significant infection. And you might say, well, that's a very small number. And it is a very small number when you compare it to some of the other everyday, every year risks at least in New Zealand life. But maybe that 1.8 million, 1 in 1.8 million risk is an underestimate. Next slide tells us what kind of organisms are transmitted and have led to infections through endoscopes. And in the gastroenterology literature, it's mostly Pseudomonas and Salmonella. As I said before, there are no cystoscopy or ENT-related infections. And amongst bronchoscopy, there have been about 7 reports of TB transmitted through bronchoscopes, 8 with Pseudomonas, and 3 with other coliforms. This was in a review up to 2003. And what's interesting about the bronchoscopes is that more often there are pseudo-outbreaks than true outbreaks. And so that you understand what a pseudo-outbreak is, what it means is that the bronchoscope has become contaminated with an organism such as a mycobacterium or a Pseudomonas or a mold. And that bronchoscope fails to be cleaned as it's reprocessed. So each case has a bronchoscopy with that scope, and saline is flushed down into the patient, sucked back, and sent to the laboratory and grows this organism. So you might have 20 or 30 patients who are all having bronchoalveolar lavage samples sent to the lab, and they all grow the same organism. And it means that the bronchoscope is contaminated, and all of those patients have had that organism possibly flushed into their lungs, but only a small number of them, if any, will have a true infection from that organism. And that's what a pseudo-outbreak is. And the next slide shows, again, just how well we seem to manage the prevention of infections by endoscopy. An estimated 10 million endoscopies are performed per year around the world, but there's never been a proven HIV transmission event, and there's only been a small number of hepatitis B and C transmissions. So the estimated 1 in 1.8 million risk is for any organism, bacteria, mycobacteria, and viruses. And it's a very low risk, and we're about to talk about why it's so low. Okay, the reason why it's so low, if you move on to the next slide, is because you people, on the whole, do a very good job of reprocessing the endoscope. And I'm not an expert in the exact procedure for this, although I've done it myself a few times in the distant past, but I'll run through it quickly just to remind you of what should be happening. First of all, when the scope comes out of a patient, it needs to be wiped down and rinsed immediately before any biological material can dry out. The next slide is called reprocessing an endoscope. It's got two lines, and on the second line, I've written here that you should soak the endoscope if you're unable to clean it within a short time. And this has been a problem identified especially with the ear, nose and throat scopes. In the UK recently there was an audit that showed that these were often used in the evening and left out without being reprocessed immediately and even without being soaked overnight. On the next slide, it illustrates the leak testing. And if you can see, this is a good example of a staff member who's wearing all her personal protective equipment, mainly because she knew that I was photographing her. But nevertheless, she's leak testing the endoscope, which you should do after removing all the control buttons and having a good look for leaks around those points. And you have to flex the tip of the endoscope so that you can see any leaks in the flexible section. In the next slide, the warm water and detergent are added. And there are a whole variety of detergents, all of which work better than water alone, but which are not all the same. And there's even a non-detergent product in New Zealand and Australia called Matrix, which a lot of units use, and it seems to work as well, if not better, than the other detergents. You should use warm water and not cold, and not hot water, because the hot water may denature and damage the enzymes that make up the detergent. There have been studies that show that if you incorrectly dilute the detergent, then that will reduce its efficacy. So you have to follow the manufacturer's instructions. Detergent will moisten and penetrate any biological material and help break it down and help you rinse biological material off the endoscope by solubilizing the particles. Then you clean the outside of the endoscope. That's the next slide. And the next slide shows a staff member just cleaning the channel openings with a short cleaning brush. And you should also brush the control head, the ports, the valve seats, and the distal tip. Now, you can see here that the endoscope is fully submerged so that there aren't splashes coming back and getting onto your face and in your eyes. It's important to use the right brushes. There's been at least one event reported in the literature where the wrong brushes were used and the channel openings therefore weren't cleaned properly, and infection appeared to spread from one person to another. If your brushes are kinked or worn, then they should be replaced. Next slide shows the long cleaning brush being put down one of the channels of the endoscope. And this is important because you don't want there to be any biological material left in the endoscope at the end of cleaning. Now, inevitably, there'll be a small amount, and we know that from the studies of electron microscopy on fully cleaned endoscopes. But it's important that there's no significant amount of biological material because the disinfectant won't penetrate it, and so organisms may survive in that biological material. Now, some disinfectants also fix or harden the biological material, and glutaraldehyde is the worst at it, but peracetic acid can also do this. And in one paper, they had an endoscope that was contaminated with tuberculosis, and it hadn't been cleaned properly, so it still had some biological material, and they put it through a disinfection cycle 10 times, and at the end of 10 disinfection cycles, there was still TB on the bronchoscope. So this is an illustration of how important it is to clean the endoscope. After cleaning it, you want to rinse it and purge the channels with air so that you remove all detergent before the disinfectant is added. Excuse me. So, cleaning the endoscope, according to this next slide, which has got a graph on it of colonoscope bioburden, cleaning the endoscope actually gets rid of between 2 and 7 logs of the bacterial burden. Well, what does a log mean? Well, every log is 10 times. So if you get rid of 1 log of the bacterial burden, then you reduce it to a tenth of what it was before. If you get rid of 2 logs of the bacteria, you're reducing it to 10 to the power of 2, which is 100, so a hundredth of the amount of bacteria. So if you look at this graph from a 1998 paper, although it looks like you're only getting rid of half the bacteria, the pale blue columns are before cleaning and the dark blue are after, actually you're getting rid of something like 9,999 out of every 10,000 bacteria, or even 999,999 out of every 100,000 bacteria. You're getting rid of an enormous amount of the bacterial burden on that endoscope just by cleaning it. And we also know that cleaning gets rid of almost all the virus on an endoscope. Okay, the next slide shows the endoscope being put into an endoscope, an automated endoscope reprocessor. And it's important that you use the right connectors, because in the past there has been transmission of endoscopy of organisms through endoscopes where the wrong connectors were used, and therefore inadequate rinsing and disinfectant was pushed down some channels of the endoscope. The next slide is a picture of an Olympus endoscope reprocessing machine, and this is just as a prompt to remind people that the reprocessing machine will rinse, then soak the endoscope for a certain number of minutes, which will differ according to the disinfectant you're using and the temperature of that disinfectant, and then rinse again. And a good modern endoscope reprocessing machine will have a number of alarms and default functions, so that if there's any problem with that cycle, for example, if you haven't connected the endoscope correctly, or there's a bit of biological material in one channel and no flow is going through that channel, then the cycle will abort and the machine will tell you there's been a fault and that it can't guarantee the disinfection of that particular endoscope. There should also be a self-disinfection cycle on any endoscope reprocessing machine, which either uses heat or a different disinfectant to usual, so that any biological material that's left within the internal channels and bowls of the reprocessing machine is eliminated. Right, the next slide is also a list titled Reprocessing an Endoscope. And the final stage, or almost the final stage, is rinsing the endoscope with sterile water. And we're going to talk more about that later. But there have been a number of outbreaks that in the earlier days of endoscopy were associated with using tap water to rinse the endoscope. And more recently with what should be sterile water but has become contaminated. Next slide shows the next part of the procedure, which is where you dry the endoscope internal channels with 70% alcohol and forced air. Now, the alcohol at this point in the procedure has an additional antibacterial, antiviral effect, but there shouldn't really be any organisms by this stage. So although it may be an advantage to kill any bacteria or viruses that are still there, the primary role of the alcohol flush and followed by forced air is to dry the endoscope so that any remaining organisms won't be able to proliferate in moisture. Next slide shows some endoscopes hanging in a cupboard. And this illustrates how important it is to hang the endoscope straight and in a well-ventilated cupboard. And you should disassemble them as much as possible for storage so that there can be air movement. Still, if you handle the scopes while hanging them up, they will be lightly contaminated with organisms from your own hands. And if there's any moisture on the endoscope, then this could cause multiplication of those bacteria and affect the next patient. So in New Zealand and in Australia, we are told that we should reprocess each endoscope for the first use of each day of use, but some other organisations don't recommend this. Right, the next slide is entitled Accessories. And for cleaning accessories and reprocessing them, you should follow the instructions written by the manufacturer for that accessory. In general, you should discard single-use items and not reuse them. And if they are reusable, then similar to cleaning the endoscope itself, you soak them initially, dismantle them as far as possible, then clean them, use ultrasonic treatment to shake off any biological particles that you haven't managed to get off with your normal brushing cleaning, then rinse and dry them and either sterilize them, in the case of biopsy forceps and ERCP equipment, or high-level disinfect them. And again, follow the manufacturer's instructions. The water bottles have also been the subject of some recommendations, which are to clean them manually and then either high-level disinfect them or sterilize them once a day according to the manufacturer's instructions. Store them dry and use sterile water only. Okay, well, we've talked about how to prevent organisms spreading from one patient to another by correct cleaning and disinfection and storage of endoscopes. But let's look at one further way that the patient could be infected during or as a result of endoscopy, and that is from the environment. Now, our environment is heavily contaminated with bacteria. Bacteria are everywhere in our planet. And if you go to the next slide, which is where does rinse water come from, you can see that the rain falls frequently onto soil, and that rain that falls on the grass and the soil around us is the start of your rinse water. The next slide is entitled Aquifers, and this shows how on the left-hand side you can see rain falling on the top of a hill between some trees, and that water then enters an underground storage space called an aquifer, which can be a source of water by a well or a some kind of well, or that water will fall and go down into a stream and end up in a lake. Now, organisms enter and contaminate the water underground and in rivers and lakes, especially the rivers and lakes where fecal matter from domestic and rural animals can get into it. The next slide, which is called the water cycle, shows how that groundwater and aquifer water goes into a water treatment plant where chemicals and bacteria are removed from the water by a number of processes. Next slide, you can see that water then is pumped through pipes and into the underground network of your hospital, where unfortunately there may be old pipes and dead end pipes where any organisms that still remain can start to form a biofilm and accumulate. So the next slide shows a picture of some bacteria on a surface, and as you move through the next three slides you can see that the bacteria are multiplying and forming a jelly-like substance that surrounds them and protects them. And many old hospital pipes have got these biofilms of living organisms in them. The next slide shows some Stereosystem 1 reprocessing machines with a bank of filters underneath. And filtration is a common way that we try to prevent these organisms coming through from the hospital water supply into your endoscopes. But if you don't regularly change these filters, then the filter themselves can become a source of biofilm and contaminating bacteria. So the next slide is entitled Contamination of Rinse Water. And a number of organisms, especially Pseudomonas, mycobacteria and molds, can contaminate your endoscope rinse water from the hospital supply or your endoscopy unit supply because of blind loop pipes in your plumbing, because of holes in the filters, or because of the machines, your endoscope reprocessing machine doesn't have an effective self-disinfection cycle to kill these organisms in its internal pipes. Next slide is called Sterile Rinse Water, and it lists a few ways that you can use in your department of sterilizing your rinse water, and the filtration is the most common. So moving on to the next slide, there's a picture of the GENCA guidelines that are followed in New Zealand and Australia, and the 2003 version is still the latest recommendation, and that's going to be changed over the years and updated, but this is what most units in New Zealand and Australia follow. And the next slide shows our handbook written by Standards New Zealand on microbiological surveillance of endoscopes, which actually has some slightly different recommendations for how to test endoscopes compared to the GENCA guidelines. But at a committee meeting 2 weeks ago, we've rationalised those and we're going to rewrite the guidelines so that they're identical. Now, how often should you be testing endoscopes? Should you be doing it at all? This is still a subject of debate, and in particular the American recommendations don't support yet the need for testing endoscopes. But our experience in New Zealand and Australia after 7 or 8 years of doing this, and this will soon be published, is that, in fact, the surveillance cultures are very good at detecting internal endoscope damage that is not apparent in any other way. And they are also good at picking up problems with technique, with reprocessing the endoscope, so faulty cleaning techniques. And when there is a problem with a machine, an endoscope reprocessing machine, a fault, the endoscope surveillance cultures can be reassuring in helping you to avoid an unnecessary patient recall or testing. So the evidence is all supportive of doing these surveillance cultures, and exactly how you do them will be communicated to you in the next GENCA guideline. So, some hot topics, and I'll run through these very quickly so that we've got at least a few minutes for questions at the end. I'm not going to talk about detergents, but very quickly, the DispaClean brush, which is also available under other names, are produced by other manufacturers. This is a brush with, rather than bristles, it has some kind of circular rubber device that is supposed to remove biological material more efficiently from the inside of a scope channel. And the next three or four slides show some graphs where you can see that the blue line with the DispaClean is better after one brush than an ordinary brush. But after you get to three cleaning procedures, three times putting the brush down and pulling it back, actually the DispaClean isn't able to get the endoscope any cleaner than an ordinary brush. Again, looking at the next slide, in terms of the number of protein, amount of protein removed, DispaClean and ordinary brush are the same. And in terms of removing biofilm, DispaClean's better than an ordinary brush after one brush, but not after three brushes. So as long as you're doing three brushes with an ordinary brush, it's as good as DispaClean. But if you're just doing one brush, DispaClean is better. And at the moment, nobody recommends just doing one brush, even with DispaClean. The next slide shows some before and after pictures of biofilms. But moving on to the summary slide for DispaClean, these cleaners are as good, if not better, than ordinary brushes. And as far as I'm concerned, you're welcome to use them. Many people do. DispaClean is only one brand that's now available. There are others that are either available or becoming available. And you're welcome to use them. But I wouldn't reduce the number of times you put the brush down the lumen yet. Which disinfectant should you use? This is the slide titled High-Level Disinfectant. I don't think I want to say anything particular about which one to use, except that I'm not aware of any difference in efficacy between all these commonly used agents. So if we move on through the Adispor slide and the Tristol Wipes slide, which is a picture of a website promoting Tristol Sporicidal Wipes as killing any organism, be it bacteria, virus, fungus or mycobacteria, within about 30 seconds. The data from the Tristol company is very promising. It does suggest that this agent works very fast, but I just don't believe it quite yet. And from my reading of the literature, which is the next slide, the next slide again, which is called Tristol Sporicidal Wipes Data, the independent research shows that chlorine dioxide has a similar efficacy to some of the other disinfectants we're using. So I'm just not yet convinced that it's fast enough to be able to clean the outside of an endoscope in 30 seconds. What about sheaths? Well, this is the next slide with a number of sheaths. These have been used more and more, and to summarise, I guess I'd say that I'm quite happy about them being used for endoscopes that don't have a lumen. And they're even bringing out sheaths now where there are two lumens to the sheath, one that covers the endoscope and the other lumen of the sheath you can pass a biopsy forcep down. And the idea is that when you remove the sheath, you then just wipe down your scope and you can put it straight away into the next patient. Unfortunately, we haven't really had enough data to be able to recommend these formally under any GENCA or other guideline yet. And so I know they're being used a lot, but we can't fully recommend them without some more study and more committee deliberations, I'm afraid. So moving through several more slides, and we come to a picture of the bottom of a Steris System 1 endoscope reprocessing machine where there's a grill at the bottom of the machine. And this is a problem that we recently had in New Zealand, and I think people should watch out for overseas, that this is the filter which collects fluff and biological material and anything else that might be floating around in your rinse water after you've reprocessed your endoscopes in a Sterisystem 1 machine. And what we found is that little fragments of plastic had been getting through this grill and moving through the internal water pipes of the Sterisystem 1 and potentially going through and blocking the ports, taking disinfectant into an endoscope channel. And so Steris in New Zealand has brought out a much finer filter, which we believe has solved this problem. And I think it may be worth asking about in Australia and overseas too, if you're interested. Next slide is entitled Scrapie, which is the animal form of spongiform encephalopathy. The next slide is Kuru, which is the first recognized human form of a spongiform encephalopathy. And the next slide is a purple, green, black picture showing how these diseases, scrapie, Kuru, and really any form of spongiform encephalopathy are transmitted. It's not actually an infection. It's a piece of protein that changes shape. And when it changes shape, if you look at the next slide, you can see that it changes the shape of the other proteins next to it, and it becomes a chain reaction. And these changing proteins end up damaging the cell in which the proteins exist. Particularly, they are found in brain tissue. So if you turn to the slide, where is abnormal prion protein found? You see that it's mostly in human and animal brain, and the dura mater, which is the lining of the brain, spinal cord, which is also part of the brain, and the eye, which has the optic nerve entering it. But occasionally these abnormal prion proteins get into other organs, and of great relevance to endoscopy, especially with this variant form of CJD, the prion proteins can be found in the lymph tissues in the gastrointestinal tract. So moving on to the slide, how do humans get CJD? The variant form, which has been transmitted in the United Kingdom relating to eating beef, that's the form that could be transmitted by endoscopy from person to person through gastrointestinal endoscopy. And you cannot remove these prion proteins from an endoscope. So moving a couple of slides on to one called the risk via endoscopy, both the JINCA and the British Society of Gastroenterology recommend that you avoid, if you can, doing endoscopy in these cases. But if you do, then once you've used an endoscope on a patient with suspected variant CJD, you must not use that endoscope on anyone else unless that other person is also suspected to have the variant CJD. And in most countries, there's now probably there are some endoscopes that have been used and put aside and are available for CJD patients.
Thank you very much, Richard. That's great. I know you have an awful lot to cover in a very short space of time. I think you do it excellently. In closing, I'd like to thank you very much, Richard, for your important contribution to this series. You started off, I think, the 2007 South Pacific teleclass really, really well, so thank you. From all of us here in Christchurch, thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye for now.